Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. It is big announcement day, and should we do the big announcement first? Nah, let's do the chapter first. You're going to have to wait a little bit longer. We're up to Epilogue 1, Chapter 6. At the beginning of winter, Princess Mary came to Moscow. From reports current in town, she learned how the Rostovs were situated and how the son has sacrificed himself for his mother, as people were saying. "I never expected anything else of him," said Princess Mary to herself, feeling a joyous sense of her love for him. Remembering her friendly relations with all the Rostovs, which had made her almost a member of the family, she thought it her duty to go to see them. But remembering her relations with Nicholas in Vorenz, she was timid about doing so. Making a great effort, she did, however, go to call on them a few weeks after her arrival in Moscow. Nicholas was the first to meet her, as the Countess's room could only be reached through his. But instead of being greeted with pleasure, as she had expected, at his first glance at her, his face assumed a cold, stiff and proud expression she had not seen on it before. He inquired about her health, led the way to his mother, and having sat there for 5 minutes, left the room. When the princess came out of the countess's room, Nicholas met her again, and with marked solemnity and stiffness accompanied her to the anteroom. To her remarks about his mother's health he made no reply. "What's that to you? Leave me in peace," his looks seemed to say. "Why does she come prowling here? What does she want? I can't bear these ladies and all these civilities," said he aloud in Sonya's presence, evidently unable to repress his vexation after the princess's carriage had disappeared. "Oh, Nicholas, how can you talk like that?" cried Sonya, hardly able to conceal her delight. "She is so kind, and Mama is so fond of her." Nicholas did not reply, and tried to avoid speaking of the princess any more, but after her visit the old countess spoke of her several times a day. She sang her praises, insisted that her son must call on her, expressed a wish to see her often, but yet always became ill-humoured when she began to talk of her. Nicholas tried to keep silence when his mother spoke of the princess, but his silence irritated her. "She is a very admirable and excellent young woman," said she, "and you must go and call on her. You must, at least, be seeing somebody, and I think it must be dull for you only seeing us." "But I don't in the least want to, Mama." "You used to want to, and now you don't. Really, I don't understand you, my dear. One day you are dull, and the next you refuse to see anyone." "But I never said I was dull." "Why, you said yourself you don't want even to see her. She is a very admirable young woman, and you always liked her. But now, suddenly, you have got some notion or other in your head. You hide everything from me."
"Not at all, Mother."
"If I were asking you to do something disagreeable now, but I only ask you to return a call. One would think mere politeness required it. Well, I have asked you, and now I won't interfere any more, since you have secrets from your mother."
"Well, then I'll go if you wish."
"It doesn't matter to me. I only wish it for your sake." Nicholas sighed, but his mustache, and laid out the cards for patience, trying to divert his mother's attention to another topic. The same conversation was repeated the next day, and the day after, and the day after that. After her visit to the Rostovs and her unexpectedly chilly reception by Nicholas, Princess Mary confessed to herself that she had been right in not wishing to be the first to call. "I expected nothing else," she told herself, calling up her pride to her aid. "I have nothing to do with him, and I only wanted to see the old lady, who was always kind to me, and to whom I am under many obligations." But she could not pacify herself with these reflections. A feeling akin to remorse troubled her when she thought of her visit.
though she had firmly resolved not to call on the Rostovs again, and to forget the whole matter, she felt herself all the time in an awkward position. And when she asked herself what distressed her, she had to admit that it was her relation to Rostov. His cold, polite manner did not express his feeling for her, she knew that, but it concealed something. And until she could discover what that something was, she could not, she felt, be at ease. One day in midwinter, when sitting in the schoolroom attending to her nephew's lessons, she was informed that Rostov had called. With a firm resolution not to betray herself and not show her agitation, she sent for Mademoiselle Bourienne and went with her to the drawing-room. Her first glance at Nicholas's face told her that he had only come to fulfil the demands of politeness, and she firmly resolved to maintain the tone in which he addressed her. They spoke of the Countess's health, of their mutual friends, of the latest war news, and when the 10 minutes required by propriety had elapsed, after which a visitor may rise, Nicholas got up to say goodbye. With Mademoiselle Bourienne's help, the Princess had maintained the conversation very well, but at the very last moment, just when he arose, she was so tired of talking of what did not interest her, and her mind was so full of question why she alone was granted so little happiness in life, that in a fit of absent-mindedness she sat still, her luminous eyes gazing fixedly before her, not noticing that he had risen. Nicholas glanced at her, wishing to appear not to notice her abstraction, made some remark to Mademoiselle Bourienne, and then again looked at the princess. She still sat motionless, with a look of suffering on her gentle face. He suddenly felt sorry for her, and was vaguely conscious that he might be the cause of the sadness her face expressed. He wished to help her and say something pleasant to her, but could think of nothing to say. "Goodbye, princess," he said. She started, flushed, and sighed deeply. "Oh, I beg your pardon," she said, as if waking up. "Are you going already, Count? Well, then, goodbye. Oh, but the cushion for the Countess." "Wait a moment, I'll fetch it," said Mademoiselle Bourienne, and she left the room. They both sat silent, with an occasional glance at one another. "Yes, Princess," said Nicholas at last, with a sad smile, "it doesn't seem long ago since we first met at Bogachurovo. But how much water has flowed since then! In what distress we all seemed to be then! Yet I would give much to bring back that time, but there is no bringing it back." Princess Mary gazed intently into his eyes with her own luminous ones as he said this. She seemed to be trying to fathom the hidden meaning of his words, which would explain his feeling for her. "Yes, yes," said she, "but you have no reason to regret the past, Count. As I understand your present life, I think you will always recall it with satisfaction, because the self-sacrifice that fills it now." "I cannot accept your praise," he interrupted her hurriedly. "On the contrary, I continually reproach myself. But this is not at all an interesting or cheerful subject." His face again resumed its former stiff and cold expression, but the princess had caught a glimpse of the man she had known and loved, and it was to him that she now spoke. "I thought you would allow me to tell you this," she said. "I had come so near to you, and to all your family, that I thought you would not consider my sympathy misplaced. But I was mistaken." And suddenly her voice trembled. "I don't know why," she continued, recovering herself, "but you used to be different, and..." "There are 1,000 reasons why," he said. He laid special emphasis on the why. "Thank you, Princess," he added softly. "Sometimes it is hard." "So that's why, that's why," a voice whispered in Princess Mary's soul. No, it was not only that gay, kind, and frank look, not only that handsome exterior that I loved in him. I divined his noble, resolute, self-sacrificing spirit too, she said to herself. Yes, he is poor now, and I am rich. Yes, that's the only reason. Yes, were it not for that. And remembering his former tenderness and looking now at his kind, sorrowful face, she suddenly understood the cause of his coldness. But why, Count, why? She almost cried, unconsciously moving closer to him. Why? Tell me, you must tell me. He was silent. I don't understand your why, Count, she continued, but it's hard for me. I confess it. For some reason you wish to deprive me of your former friendship, and that hurts me. There were tears in her eyes and in her voice. I have had so little happiness in life that every loss is hard for me to bear. Excuse me, goodbye. And suddenly she began to cry and was hurrying from the room. Princess, for God's sake, he exclaimed, trying to stop her. Princess! She turned around. For a few seconds they gazed silently into one another's eyes, and what had seemed impossible and remote suddenly became possible, inevitable, and very near. All right, there we go. That was pretty cool. That little last twist ending. It's going to happen. They were so cold, they nearly went their separate ways, and then that last minute turn around, that last minute look around, and everything reversed. And I think they're gonna do the old hookup. I think they're gonna get together. That's what that seemed like to me. Very exciting, very Days of Our Lives. Very Young and the Restless. Alright, before we get into the discussion part of the podcast, I'm going to do a little bit of advertising, just quickly. This podcast is hosted by Podbean, and it is also brought to you by Podbean. Podbean are offering listeners of this podcast one free month of podcast hosting. So if you're thinking of starting your own podcast, Podbean is the place to do it. If you would like to get your first month's podcast hosting for free, you want to go to podbean.com/Ander, A-N-D-E-R. Thank you very much for your patience there. All right, let's start with the announcement about the Hemingway list. So, this could be long. Actually, this might be long and winding, and I don't think there's much discussion about the chapter, so let's do the discussion first. I'm changing my mind on the fly. That was a roller coaster, again, of a chapter. I'm loving being back with our characters as their story arcs are all tying up. Kansas 57 said, "Do you think Nikolai interacted with Maya appropriately when she visited?" Absolutely not, I would say. He was cold, and I think he was sort of embarrassed about himself. Mellow Yellow said, "It's been a couple of months, but I'm back on schedule, and I didn't think I'd make it through some of those pontificating chapters." Pontificating, what a word. "Expressing one's opinions in a way considered annoyingly pompous and dogmatic." Mellow Yellow continues, "It looks like Nikolai is acquiescing to his life of debt and poverty and can't imagine either dragging Maya into his life or letting Maya carry his family out of the crisis." Yeah, I think that's the nail on the head there, Mellow Yellow, and I think he's just ashamed of the situation. He's ashamed. He doesn't want Maya to sort of see him like that, see his family that way. Kansas 57 also said, "Is Maya too forward?" Is she too forward? Mellow Yellow says, "No, I don't think she's being too forward. After a lifetime of callousness and mistreatment from her father and after her brother's death, Maya is done having happiness elude her, especially from the one person who has previously shown her a brightness in life. And I'm sure she's drawing some inspiration from Pierre and Natasha's rekindled love." Kansas 57 also asked, how will these events make Sonia feel? What is her future looking like? Yeah, poor Sonia. Spare a thought for Sonia. I still really hope something good comes her way. And by that I mean, like, just a good husband. Right? Is that a bad thing to say? Like, maybe that's not all she aspires to, is to, you know, have a husband. But I just want her to be fulfilled. Mallow Yellow said, are there any more living single men left? Denisov, Dolokhov, Vasily's son, Tweedledee and Tweedledum. Well, Vasily's son was Anatole, right? Have I got that right? I think he's dead now. There's the other one whose name escapes me. But what about Boris? Did he die? Dolokhov's a good option. No, wait. Denisov. Dolokhov's an asshole. Denisov is the good option. Anyway, yeah, poor old Sonia. It got exciting again. I think Maya and Nikolai are going to get together. I just hope we get to... Oh, let's be real. There's not going to be like a wedding scene, is there? Every time someone gets married, it's just like they got married. And then he moves on. Anyway, I'm excited to keep reading. All right, big announcement stuff. So, I have announced the first three books that we'll be reading from Hemingway's list. And I'll tell you them right now. Let me just load up my screen here. Okay. So, first of all, you can go to thehemingwaylist.com. Hemingway has one M. I only learnt way too late in my life. And so, here are the first three books. The first two are the Stephen Crane short stories. Stephen Crane's first one, The Open Boat, and then the second one will be The Blue Hotel. Book one, The Open Boat. Book two, The Blue Hotel, both by Stephen Crane. They're fairly short stories, but they do both have a fair few chapters. So I suppose they're not that short. They're more like little novellas. I think, from memory, they have about 10 chapters each. So even though it's just two short stories, that is a good... It'll carry us for most of the first month of the Hemingway list if we do it one chapter at a time. So those are the first two books. The third book is going to be some more short stories, Dubliners by James Joyce. Dubliners. Now, the very exciting announcement, other than announcing what the books are, is this. I am going to publish my way through Hemingway's list. So, probably some of you know that I do book stuff, and part of that is an indie publishing label. It's called Up and Up Media. Actually, I told you guys about it earlier, about the first author that I'm going to publish, a 15-year-old student of mine who writes science fiction mystery stories. He's going to be the first author that I've... Well, he is the first author that I've signed to my publishing label. And I'm going to publish some classics. I'm going to publish the 16 stories on Hemingway's list. And this plan, it all fell into place. Here's why. You know, anyone can grab a public domain work and publish it. It's royalty free. So, by all means, if you don't want to buy my versions of this book, of these books, you can get them for free and still participate. So this isn't me saying, like, you have to buy these books to continue with the Hemingway list. So anyone can publish them, which is why every publishing house, think of Penguin and Random House and HarperCollins and all of them, they've all got their own versions of the classics, right? It's because they're free to publish, so they sort of might as well. And then the thing they do, they'll either do an edit of it, and quite often they'll put their own introduction or a little analysis at the start, and that's because the analysis or the introduction or even the translation, if they decide to translate something, they can copyright that. So they can have their own version of it. I'm not really interested in copyrighting it. I just want to print the public domain, the original version of it. So, but then I never really wanted to just do that because it was kind of like, well, what's the point? You could just publish a bunch of classics and, you know, why would you buy my version of Dubliners when there's 30 other printed copies of Dubliners out there? Some of them with much nicer hardback copies, really pristine ones. Some of them that are cheaper, like budget versions of it, the thrift paperbacks. So it was kind of like, why would I publish classics? But when I had the idea to publish Hemingway's list, it kind of gave it a purpose. Like, I'm not just randomly publishing classics. I'm publishing a specific set of classics that are important to me. And here's why it's important to me. So Hemingway is my idol as a writer. He was quoted as saying, like, artists should never compete against other artists. They should only compete against dead artists. Which sort of means to say, don't compete with your peers. Like, you're meant to seek mentorship from the greats, from the dead greats. And so that's exactly what I do with him. So I've got this weird relationship with Hemingway. He is my favorite author of all time. And I compete with him. Every time I write something, I think I want this to be better than Hemingway. Right? Which is, you know, I'll probably never achieve that. Right? But that's what I try to do. And that's how I get the best out of myself. The weird thing is, and this gets a bit like, bit strange, but I've actually never read Hemingway. Why? Why would my favorite author be one that I've never read? Right, it's weird, isn't it? Because what I do is I invent in my head how great he is. I know he is one of the greatest writers of all times. He asked me to compete with him, with that quote, to compete with dead heroes. And so it's like I create this unreachably great writing in my head, like what Hemingway is, and then I try to beat it. And then I can kind of take credit for whatever it is that I create, because the thing I was competing with was actually of my own imagination as well. Does that make sense? It's a really weird concept. There's this other quote about Hemingway that was something like this. This is paraphrasing it because I don't know who said this or the exact phrase, but it's always stuck in my head. It's probably something you could Google quite easily. It was something like, Hemingway was so influential as a writer, so influential, that after reading Hemingway, all writers were either, they went into one of two categories. They were trying to be like Hemingway, or they were trying to not be like Hemingway. And that was it. There was no other category. He was so influential that he had an effect on you one way or the other. Right. What a thing to say about someone. But then again, I circumvent that by never having read Hemingway. But I still call him my favorite. And so if I'm going to compete with this guy, I'm going to take all the advice he's got to offer, because he's actually helping me out. And lo and behold, he's bestowed to us this list of 16 books, which he says, if you want to be a great writer like me, these are the books you should read. And that's Hemingway's list. And so this has been something circling around my head for a good, I'm going to say 12 years, 10 to 12 years. I've known about this list, and I've called Hemingway my favorite, and I've competed with him in this weird fashion. And so I've always intended to read those books, but just never did, never got around to doing it. Haven't actually read any of them, I don't think, weirdly. And so when I kind of came up with that idea, it was about midway through the year of doing A Year of War and Peace. It just sat perfectly. And it also reignited this idea that I'd had maybe a year previous to that of publishing all the books in that set. I'd had that idea probably, I'm going to say probably 2 years ago now. I was like, I should publish all the books in Hemingway's list. But the thing that stopped me from doing it was that I hadn't edited them and changed them and typeset them. And I didn't want to do them all in one big batch. And then it was like, well, it's going to take me a couple of years to get them all ready. And so it's something I could just chip away at in the background. And I just never got around to starting the project. But now it's kind of like, well, if I just print them and release them as we get to them via this podcast, then that kind of keeps me to a schedule. So, you know, I've printed the first three. And then as we approach, you know, the end of Dubliners, I'll do the next one and that'll become available for sale. And then the next one and the next one. And then at the time we finish the podcast, the whole set will be available. And I'm thinking that the last book we will do in the set will be War and Peace again. We'll do it for a second time, but that won't be for a few years yet. That's the plan. So what I've done is I've taken Stephen Crane's two short stories, The Open Boat and The Blue Hotel, and I've combined them into one volume. So the first book I have published is those two stories by Stephen Crane. The second book I have published is Dubliners by James Joyce. I had a really good time putting together the cover. I took very good care to choose the images that are on the front. Something that would sum up the story, something that really depicts it, and also pictures that are in the public domain that I was free to use as well. And so I'm really proud of how they look. I think they look beautiful. And I've also typeset them in my favorite font for typesetting, which is Arabic typesetting. So inside, they're going to look really, really nice as well. I'm just really happy with this. And the other cool thing is that when we get around to reading the first book on Hemingway's list, I'm going to be reading it from a paperback edition that I published. And I don't know, I just feel kind of proud of that. Now, I do want to reiterate and stress that you guys don't have to buy these books if you want to participate. You can get all of the books on Hemingway's list are in the public domain, so you can find them fairly easily just by a Google search. You know, type the name of the book and write something like full text, and you'll find it really easily. You can also find, you know, obviously copies of the books in bookshops, in used bookshops, on Kindle and ebook and all those. There's bound to be a whole bunch of people who have published them for all different prices. So you will not struggle to find a free version or a cheap version of these texts. Mine are, I think, decently priced. They sit at around $20 for the paperback. Now, that is a bit more expensive than the others because classics go cheap. You know, Penguin pumps them out for about $10. So the reason you would buy my copies is purely to support an independent publishing label. And, you know, I'm trying to grow this label so that I can publish more young and up-and-coming authors, and also as a way to support the podcast. I think it'll be really, really awesome in a few years' time, once all the books are out, you'll have this sort of box set of 15 books, and they'll all line up nicely and look like a set on your bookcase. So I'm looking forward to doing that myself. So if you want to see how these first two books look, the Stephen Crane one and the James Joyce one, there's a few ways you can do it. You can go to thehemingwaylist.com, thehemingwaylist.com, and on the sidebar, there's a button that says Our Official Paperbacks. If you click that, if you're on a mobile, you actually have to scroll down to the bottom of the page to find those buttons. Scroll, scroll, scroll all the way down, and you'll see one, Our Official Paperbacks. Alternatively, you can go to the Up and Up Media website, upandupmedia.com.au, and click on the link that says The Hemingway List. There's a little page about that on there. Thirdly, if you're on the Hemingway list subreddit, I've been posting pictures on there as well. So you won't have to go far to find these pictures of these new paperback books. Now, I think there's a discount available at the moment on Amazon, because when I go and have a look at it, it says, save $5 on orders over $20, applicable promotion. Giftbook 18, that's the promo code, Giftbook 18, save $5 when you spend $20 or more on books shipped and sold by Amazon.com. Huh, that's kind of cool. So there you go, you can save $5. Look, I just hope this is as exciting for anyone else as it is for me. I'm really excited, you can probably tell. It also says if you order them now, they'll arrive within one day. Really? Within one day? That must be for Americans. I don't think that's the case with Australians because they get sent over from America. But if you're in America, yeah, you can definitely get these in time for Christmas or in time for the new year when we'll start reading these books. Really quick about these, what we're going to read first, the Stephen Crane ones, I'm excited. It's an American author. And The Blue Hotel seems a bit like, not quite a Western, but like that kind of gritty thing. It's like an existential story about a card game in a hotel that ends in violence. Just sounds exciting. And The Open Boat by Stephen Crane as well is about a shipwrecked crew surviving on a small boat, I think. Something like that. I haven't read them. It was funny to publish them without reading them because I typeset them and I spruced them up and I changed the formatting a lot and made them look way nicer than how they were presented online. So they look really, really nice, and I kind of scanned through them to look for formatting errors and for print errors, but didn't actually read the stories. So I am going to be reading them with you for the first time. So it's kind of weird to publish a book that you haven't read, right? But then again, I can be quite sure that there's no errors in it because these stories are, you know, from the 1800s. So I'm quite sure that by now they've found the typos. So I'm excited for those Stephen Crane ones. They actually sound almost like pulp fiction kind of things, don't they? Like quite exciting. And then Dubliners by James Joyce. James Joyce is said to be one of the most important writers of all time. And Dubliners is his anthology of short stories that it's just kind of endless analysis in literary circles on Dubliners. It's like no one can say exactly what Dubliners is, and there's just so much kind of debate, and there's all these different takes on what he's done with that book. But the thing that he's definitely done with it is kind of pioneer some new ground in the literary world. So, very excited to read Dubliners, get stuck into some James Joyce. This is going to be great. I do regret that we're not going to be doing the Les Mis thing. And I will miss the people who, you know, if we do split off into different factions, literary gangs. But like I said in the previous podcast, there's nothing a bit of gang violence can't resolve. You know what? I got to tell you guys, I had a comment on yesterday's podcast. I have to read it to you guys if I can find it here. Yeah, so in the previous podcast, I was saying that Who Was Once Delight is a serial killer and a disgusting Victor Hugo-loving fool or something like that. Quite clearly kidding. One user left a comment saying, you know what, I was liking it until you decided to spoil it. Really, I'm not listening to you anymore. I suppose that person has chosen a side. They will be going to the Les Mis subreddit. I just found that hilarious that someone seems to have missed the fact that I was completely joking and that I have nothing but love for all the people who have come out of A Year of War and Peace. All right. That is a long podcast, a long announcement. Thank you for sitting through it. I will see you tomorrow.